This is number 0049, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0049. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet comic and actor Paul Provenza. He's the author of a new book, plus he's also the host and executive producer of a great television show called The Green Room.
I just tried as best as possible to recreate the vibe of a green room. And by that I mean basically comedians really talking freely and really feeling like they're not being judged and they're not trying to impress an audience, they're talking amongst themselves. After all my millions of years of experience in that kind of environment, you know, trying to get comedians to really be like they are only when amongst each other is a lot like trying to get pandas to mate in captivity. You know, everything's got to be just right or nobody gets hard.
There's also Stephen Paul Leyva, author of Blood is Pretty. The lead character is called The Fixer. Who is he?
Well, The Fixer is the hero. The Fixer is a common term in mob parlance and in big-time corporate world. A person who's a fixer is who fixes problems that people can't solve other ways. He's an old-fashioned hero in the sense that he harkens back to, like, The Saint or James Bond, as opposed to more of the sort of tortured souls mystery characters that are prevalent today. He works, I think, with wit and aplomb as he solves the problems of the denizens of a particular geographic location known as Hollywood.
And actor Geraint Wyn-Davies, who is doing a one-man show about Dylan Thomas called Do Not Go Gentle.
It was written by a great friend of mine, Leon Pownall. Both of us were Welsh men who came to Canada. And of course, Dylan Thomas was born in Swansea, and I was born about 2 miles away from where he was born. And I've always been fascinated with words, and of course, other than Shakespeare, one of the great wordsmiths of history was Dylan Thomas. And so I found that Leon's take on Thomas's life and his works just strikes a chord in me that I think with each passing year, ages, just resonates more.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0049, is Luc Gauthier, cameraman and editor with Global News here in Montreal, the other place that I work at. And by the way, Luc is also a very nice guy. And I thank you very much, Luc, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a story from Mexico City. A man with a mysterious bulge under his t-shirt was stopped, searched, and detained at Mexico City's International Airport after authorities found 18 tiny endangered monkeys in a girdle he was wearing. The Public Safety Department said that 38-year-old Roberto Cabrera arrived on a commercial flight from Lima, Peru, when authorities noticed the bulge and conducted a body search. The department said Cabrera was carrying the 6-inch TT monkeys in pouches attached to the girdle. Two of the monkeys were dead. Cabrera was arrested on charges of trafficking an endangered species. Cabrera told authorities he was carrying the monkeys in a suitcase, but decided to put them in a girdle instead because, quote, so the X-rays wouldn't hurt them. Ah, isn't that touching? From a smuggler. Yeah. Meanwhile, moving right along, the force was with a man when he robbed a bank wearing a Darth Vader mask and a cape. Armed with a gun instead of a lightsaber, the man entered a Chase Bank branch in Setauket, New York, which is about 50 miles east of New York City, and demanded cash from a teller. He fled through a parking lot with an undisclosed amount of cash. The bandit, dressed as the Star Wars villain, was part of a mini-outbreak of unusual bank robbers in the New York area. Earlier in the week, New York City police arrested a man accused of robbing two banks with a bunch of flowers and a potted plant. At least they're creative. Okay, on to the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Dwayne Lamont Moton, age 20, was estranged from his wife and came up with a way to prove his wife was a bad mother so he could gain custody of their 3-year-old son. Moton hired a friend to shoot him, this according to the Dallas, Texas police, so that he could testify his wife's boyfriend did it. Now, this is a quote from the police officers. Two individuals trying to frame a third individual. Not exactly a good idea. Investigators said the friend, Jacob Wheeler, age 20, fired the shots, but Moton realized he was shot a little worse than he had planned and began screaming for help. Too late. He died, and Wheeler has been charged with murder. Again, here's a quote from the police. There is a legal way to get custody of a child. Taking a bullet and ultimately dying is definitely not one of those ways. Wow. Well, you know, considering the kind of father he was or is, yeah, I guess was works here, maybe the child in question is lucky. Yeah. Okay, here's another lucky child. During a child custody battle in Melbourne, Australia, an unnamed woman was ordered by a judge to stop nursing her son. That may sound outrageous, but it's at the request of the boy. He's 6 years old and complained his mother tried to get him to suckle when his parents visited with him for the first time in 5 years. The court awarded custody of the boy to his nanny, who has been caring for him for those 5 years, and the parents may be deported. So there you go. On to Pasadena, California. Police said a California woman tried to run over a man with her car, then hurled a bag of urine at the arresting officers. Pasadena Lieutenant Chris Russ said 39-year-old Monica Avila was booked for investigation of attempted murder. Investigators said the brother of Avila's ex-boyfriend notified police there was a trespasser on his property at about 3 a.m. When the 44-year-old man went outside to talk to Avila, she allegedly tried to run him over with her vehicle and then fled. Police spotted her a short time later and pulled her over. The lieutenant said Avila suddenly removed her urostomy bag and threw it at the 3 arresting officers, who were splashed with urine. I bet when the cops left the station on that or any night, heck, when the cops left the academy, I bet they never thought someone would toss a urostomy bag at them filled with urine someday in their careers. I bet it never crossed their mind. Well, there you go. Okay. On to Salt Lake City. A Utah man is accused of violating a protective order because he allegedly sent letters to his estranged wife's cat. That's right, his wife's cat. Authorities said 32-year-old Ronald Charles Dallas of South Salt Lake was ordered not to contact his wife, who is the alleged victim in a domestic violence case against him. Prosecutors allege Dallas mailed 11 letters from jail that were addressed to her cat, Molly Judge, and also to a neighbor, but were intended for his wife. They say the letters asked her not to testify against him. Dallas now faces 11 counts of violation of a protective order and 2 counts of tampering with a witness. You know, maybe he should have written the letter directly to the cat, as opposed to just addressing it to the cat. Although I'm sure the judge would have seen through that, too. Anyway. One more story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A group of captive monkeys from a primate research center in Japan recently escaped by using springy tree branches to catapult themselves over an electric fence that's more than 16 feet tall. At least a dozen monkeys were able to hop the fence, but they didn't do much with their newfound freedom. Caretakers found a few hanging just outside the fence, and 5 were lured back in using peanuts. So, there you go. They just wanted to taste freedom. They didn't necessarily want to experience it fully. But who knows what they might do next time. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have for you now another interview that I did while doing double duty for Just for Laughs. This was one of the interviews that I really, really wanted to get. It is with comic and actor Paul Provenza. He's got a couple of projects of note. One is an absolutely marvelous television show called The Green Room, which interviews comics. Frankly, I can't say enough about this show. I love it to death, and I'm mildly envious of Paul because With this show, he has a gig that I would love to do. You can catch the show on Showtime in the U.S. and on the Movie Network here in Canada. He also has another project dealing with interviewing comics, but this time it's in the written form. It's a book called Satiristas. Well, I caught up with Paul at the gathering place of the Just for Laughs Festival, which is the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Montreal. We chatted in the wee hours of the morning till the sun came up, but right now here is just a brief part of what we had to say to each other. Talking to Paul Provenza, who has put together what I think is one of the finest television shows I've ever seen, called The Green Room, and it's only 6 episodes.
And you've seen 4 television shows. Five, maybe?
Yes. Yeah.
That's not bad. It's the highest percentage I've had in quite a while.
I remember talking to you a couple of years ago here at the festival when you were putting this idea together.
Ixnay on the Arkintay. My wife is here.
And you were talking about this concept, and you were doing it live. And you were going to put it on film, and now I've had a chance to see it. It's Showtime in the United States. Here in Canada, it's on the Movie Network. Tell us a little bit about The Green Room, because it's a phenomenal idea.
Well, thanks. Well, the Green Room is, as its title, I just tried as best as possible to recreate the vibe of a green room. And by that, I mean basically comedians really talking freely and really feeling like they're not being judged and they're not trying to impress an audience. They're talking amongst themselves. And after all my millions of years of experience in that kind of environment, you know, trying to get comedians to really be like they are only when amongst each other is a lot like trying to get pandas to mate in captivity. You know, everything's got to be just right or nobody gets hard. And it just because it really comes from, I just wanted some authenticity in comedy. You know, television comedy, certainly in America, I don't know about Canada, but certainly in America, television comedy has become so sterile and not true for sitcoms or narratives. I mean, there's some really terrific, innovative stuff, but, you know, look at what comedians are relegated to, talk shows, you know, and look at talk shows. They're cookie cutter, they're just, I don't know what they're about, but they're not about comedy. There's some great sketch work, there's some great comedy that happens, but not any real conversation or anything really funny coming out of that conversation. They shouldn't call them talk shows anymore, you know? So it's not really a talk show. It's more like a jazz show.
Right.
You know, comedians are the different jazz musicians, and it's verbal jazz. And we eschewed, which is a great word, really, I want to bring that into more of my conversations. We eschewed showbiz trappings. The show has no beginning. You're brought into the show mid-conversation. And so so right off the bat, we wanted you to feel like, oh, this isn't a normal thing. Whatever it is, it's not what we're normally used to. And it really is comedians talking. And the conversation goes wherever it wants. There's no agenda. And I firmly believe that you put talent in a room to do what talent does. I know with these people, no matter where the conversation goes, no matter how heavy it goes, it's going to be all that more hilarious. I've seen it happen nonstop my entire life.
I said to you off air that I was jealous of this show that you have created. And one of the many reasons I feel jealous is because you're a classically trained actor, you're a stand-up comic, and you are also somebody...
I'm trying to block the wind here a little for you. Is that good?
That's
author,
fine.
Right. Author. Published author.
I'm getting to that. Will you please? I'm trying to stretch a 2-minute interview into a 90-minute special.
Yeah.
Work with me, Dan.
And I'm going to get to the author part in a moment.
See?
But...
These Jews, they're always so impatient.
You're obviously a historian of the art form. So, from that perspective,
not really, but you know what it is? It's like...
All I'm doing
right now is what I've done my entire life. Yeah. It's just people listen to me talk about it.
Yeah. So what's it like for you when you get to sit down and talk to somebody like a Tom Smothers,
Jonathan Winters,
Robert Klein? What's it like for you to sit down and hear those stories?
It's just the coolest thing in the world. I mean, it's exactly what I felt when I was 16, 17, getting into the world of comedy back in the late 30s during the war in Germany. Back in the 70s, late 70s, mid 70s, you know, I started doing stand-up, you know, sort of trying it out in high school. And by the time I was in college, I was a working professional. And so it's been like my entire life. And that's what it feels like on that show. It's like when I, even back in the beginning, you know, any comedian who I thought was good, even if I had just seen them do a set in some showcase club somewhere, I feel the same things that I felt then. It's just like I'm around people who know what this is and are just like, it's like I'm like some jazz cat sitting around listening to, you know, Ornette Coleman. It's like, it's just, you know, that's what comedy is. It's that kind of art form. You know, that's really where this comes from, is that I have to keep going back to the music analogy, because as romantic as it is, it's also something that people immediately understand, and that even that contrast makes it interesting. But people don't think of comedy in the same way they think of music. Like, if your child is a prodigy, a musical prodigy of some kind, at the age of 5 or 6 or something like that, boom, you just get them lessons everywhere, encourage this, this is amazing, you're showing your kids over here. Your kid's a prodigy at comedy, he gets in trouble constantly, you know? And so I forgot where I was going, because I'm a little high, because we're at the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival.
Let's talk a little bit about the book then, because you have a book that just came out.
No, seriously, that was like the serious high rantings, wasn't it?
I know, but
now I understand what happened to Ronald Reagan.
Okay, you have a book that's just come out.
Yeah.
And it's also a book that is kind of, to a certain degree, a little bit of an extension of the show that you've done, The Green Room.
Yeah, it kind of. Yeah. It's kind of straddles the midpoint between The Green Room and The Aristocrats, really, in some ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How did the book come about?
Boy, when I'm like a dog with a bone, aren't I?
Yeah. how did the book come out? And let's mention the title.
Satiristas. The book came about, actually, because of Dan Dion, the brilliant photographer, art photographer, portrait artist.
And interrupter.
Interrupter. shameless plugger.
Yes, shameless plugger, yes.
I had seen his work here at the Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. And always admired it. I'd seen it at Gotham in New York, and always thought, man, this guy is good. Because I got this feeling from it, like, you know, normally you see pictures of comedians and it's either headshots or they're being wacky or what, I don't know what it is, but Dan, I felt like I was looking at photos of comedians, like the way those guys used to photograph jazz cats in the 50s. Right. You know, there was just something moody or something. They were really evocative. They somehow respected an artist in some way. I got that kind of feeling from Dan's work. And then I was working in Sydney, Australia, and he's exhibiting in the Comedy Store in Sydney where I'm working. And I meet him, and I'm like, dude, I love your work. And we start talking, and blah, blah, blah. By the end of the week, he tells me, look, I got a publisher on board and a book agent on board to do a book with all my photographs of comedians. I need some text. Would you write this with me? I was like, absolutely. 3.5 years later, I'm going to kill this son of a bitch. The most miserable 3 years of my life. No, well, that's partially true, but it just turned out to be an unbelievable commitment and amount of work, because we ended up with, in the book, are 60 comedians, comedian, myself and so-and-so, conversations, not really interviews, nothing journalistic about it. I really just wanted to have conversations, comic-to-comic conversations. People who do satire or socially critical comedy or subversive comedy, or people just the work is about opposing the status quo. So everybody from Tom Lehrer, Tommy, the Smothers Brothers, Randy Newman, to like Doug Stanhope and Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert, Henry Rollins, whose spoken word is very funny, and he I connected him with Craig Ferguson, who is the same punk DNA. You know, Ferguson started as a punk rocker. You know, Bing Hitler. Isn't that awesome? And you know, so these are sort of through lines of where all this comes from. It's just kind of these random slices of these conversations that we have with all these people who work in this particular arena, and so it becomes about the politics of it. It becomes about the personal issues. It becomes about their histories. It becomes about the comedy. It becomes about craft. It becomes about media. All these things. The conversations were allowed to meander wherever they want to go, and then we chose them to flow together so that you just get in the mindset of people who think like this and who speak about it for a living.
God, just put a minute. With all the things you've done, is there something...
You really wanted a soundbite, didn't you?
No, not at all. Okay, all right. No, okay. With all the things that you've done... Yeah. Is there something you haven't had the opportunity to do that you're dying to do? Or someone you want to talk to in the same vein of either your book or The Green Room?
Too many to even be able to rattle off. Seriously, it's just... And, you know, new worlds have opened up and since The Aristocrats and now with the book and the series kind of happening simultaneously. And regardless of their success in any sort of conventional terms, you know, the comedy world... not only are they appreciating it, but they're respecting it, and they're sort of thankful for it. You know, they get that everything that we're doing is about just saying, man, this is an art form. You know, and if you listen to Top 40 radio and you think you know anything about music, you're sorely mistaken. And that's what most people know about comedy, this Top 40 comedy. You know, and it's a really interesting form and a lot of life lessons in it.
That's our chat with actor-comic Paul Provenza. The full title of his book is Satiristas, Comedians, Contrarians, Raconteurs, and Vulgarians. The television show, and I can't urge you enough to see it, is called The Green Room. I'm giddy because I got me a copy of all 6 shows so far on DVD, and it is now one of my prized possessions. Anyway, you'll find the show on Showtime in the United States and on the Movie Network here in Canada. As the saying goes, check your local listings. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0049, and you'll find all the required links, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order Paul's book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to author Stephen Paul Leyva about his book Blood is Pretty. And we'll meet Geraint Wyn-Davies, the actor who is in the one-man show on Dylan Thomas entitled Do Not Go Gentle. Plus, of course, there's still an idiot of the day. And, of course, lots more stuff, including stuff right here, right now. We go to London. A partial set of wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill's gold-mounted dentures, specially designed to disguise his natural lisp, go up for sale this month. The partial dentures, which Key's auctioneers have catalogued with an estimated value of £4,000 to £5,000, are being sold by the son of a technician who was commissioned to make them. A duplicate is on show at the Museum of the Royal College of Surgeons, and a third set was buried with Churchill back in 1965. According to documents written by the College of Surgeons, the dentures were, quote, carefully designed to ensure that Churchill retained his characteristically slurred diction, a deliberate affectation designed to overcome a childhood lisp.
If the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour.
Yes. Churchill lived in fear of losing his false teeth and hence his speaking voice, and insisted that spare dentures always be on hand. It added, the false teeth are the latest piece of Churchill memorabilia to go under the hammer. Earlier this year, one of his half-smoked cigars was sold for £4,500. Other items in the catalog include a broken Victorian cigar box with Churchill's initials on the lid, 2 sets of playing cards made for Churchill with a copy of his signature on the back, and an usher's armband worn at Churchill's funeral. The auction is at Key's showroom in Norwich, and it takes place at the end of July. And we go to Buenos Aires for our next story. 2 men convicted of armed robbery escaped from a prison in southeastern Argentina that was so understaffed It used mannequins to man its watchtowers, according to prison authorities. Here's a quote. "I admit we have a type of mannequin, but in this sector there are cameras that enable us to observe all movements." That's according to Daniel Vergas, who is the director of prisons. The two inmates escaped by climbing over a wall. The watchtower guarding the wall was manned by a makeshift doll nicknamed Wilson, after the ball that kept a maroon Tom Hanks company in the movie Castaway. "We made a doll with a ball and a cap so that prisoners would see a shadow and think they were being guarded," a guard said to the media. The guard also said that only two of the prison's 15 watchtowers had real guards. That's right, only two of the prison's 15 watchtowers had real guards. Local police chief Juan Carlos Le Pen has acknowledged that broken cameras and burnt-out television monitors have gone unrepaired at the prison for lack of funds. And now, of course, since the story is in the media, everyone in the prison and all their families on the outside know about it. Expect the fun to continue. Okay, on to France for our next story. Rail traffic in the south of France suffered delays after a high-speed TGV passenger train hit a truck full of shampoo. No one was hurt in the midday collision at a level crossing northeast of Montpellier, but it took several hours for workers to remove the slippery shampoo from the tracks. 19 mostly inner-city trains with around 3,000 passengers were all delayed. But hey, the tracks are now silky smooth, and the last thing you want on train tracks are split ends. Don't you think? Okay, in Lyon, New York, a 17-year-old teenager is in serious hot water after he led police on a drunken chase through his town. The teen was observed running a stop sign, and sheriff's deputies tried to stop him, but he refused to stop, and a chase ensued for almost a mile. After making an unsafe turn, the boy crashed his vehicle and took off on foot. He was later found arrested and charged with underage possession of alcohol, overdriving, reckless endangerment, failure to stop at a stop sign, and failure to yield to an emergency vehicle. What makes all this painfully interesting and a little different from your average drunk teen story is that the young lad in our story was Amish. And driving a horse and buggy at the time. Oh yeah, an endangering an animal charge also applies. Okay, on to our final story in the Stuff File News section here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest. And it deals with a profession that's also near and dear to my heart. A Taiwanese television presenter was hospitalized after a mosquito flew into her mouth, choking her and interrupting her live broadcast of a news program. The mosquito got so deep into Huang Qing's mouth that it was stuck in her windpipe, setting off severe asthma. China television company had to urgently put on a 4-minute commercial block while it drafted in a replacement presenter to carry on with the news. "I never expected a mosquito to have such a great power. It really gave me a bad day," Qing was quoted as saying after recovering from last week's unlikely interruption. The senior anchor spent a day in the hospital. Now, by the way, I checked with my television network, Global News, here in Montreal. Apparently, we are not covered for choking on mosquitoes. Now I'm kind of concerned. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. On the line with us right now is Steve Leyva, who is, among other things, an author, and one of his books is entitled Blood is Pretty. It is the first Fixer adventure, which he wrote a little while ago, and it's now coming out again, and we'll explain how that is possible. He's on the line with us now from California. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm going to ask a quick question before we get started.
Yes.
I've formed a club. I want you to join it.
And how many members in the club?
Well, at the moment, there's me, but there could be more. It's People with Three Names Club.
Ah, okay.
Okay, as you know, although you introduced me to Steve Leyva, as you know, officially I'm Stephen Paul Leyva.
Of course.
You are Peter Anthony Holder.
Right.
And I think even your announcer has three names.
Ben Patrick Johnson, that is correct.
There you go. So there's three of us in the club already.
Okay, there you go. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that when your book came out, I actually read it in manuscript form, and I actually wrote a blurb for you, which I will mention right now. I said at the time, Blood is Pretty is a light, breezy page-turner that actually had me laughing out loud. The Fixer is an engaging character, and so are the supporting characters around him. After reading Blood is Pretty, I wanted to devour more of the adventures of the Fixer, which is absolutely true. That's what I said.
And I thank you for that. What's always confused me is the book, of course, is a dark and deep tragedy. No, you pegged it perfectly, sir. I hope it is light, breezy, and a page-turner. And now you can turn the page digitally. It's so wonderful.
Well, let's go back a little bit for those who have no idea what we're talking about. Tell us about The Fixer and the first book, Blood is Pretty.
Well, The Fixer is the hero of the book. The Fixer is a common term in mob parlance and in big-time corporate world. A person who's a fixer is who fixes problems that people can't solve other ways. Now, I call him the Fixer, but I give him an extra X, so it's spelled F-I-X-X-E-R, to kind of set him aside from all that. And he's a hero. He's an old-fashioned hero in the sense that he harkens back to, like, the Saint or James Bond, as opposed to more of the sort of tortured souls, mystery characters that are prevalent today. So that's he works, I think, with wit and aplomb as he solves the problems of the denizens of a particular geographic location known as Hollywood, which I think maybe you've heard of.
Yes, indeed.
And as you know, that's fruitful fields for people full of sin and problems to be fixed. So that's where he works. And when I conceived of the character and I came up with a plot, it was a great joy to write the book. And we eventually got it published by a small publisher that, you know, it could only go so far with the smaller publishers these days. Mm. But we had a lot of fun at book signings and got good reaction. As you know, you share the blurb column with an American author few people may have heard of, Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
Gave us a cover blurb, and also the great producer of Academy Award-winning films, Richard Zanuck. And they've all responded very positively to the book. So
well, let me mention what Ray Bradbury said. He said, Steve Leiva not only promises but delivers. This is a fine first novel. Bravo. And Richard Zanuck said, Richard D. Zanuck, since he liked three names, Blood is Pretty is a wonderful read, a highly entertaining and impressive debut novel.
And I didn't have to pay anybody. They were all very good. In fact, Ray, there's a quick, I don't know if it's a funny story, but I've known Ray for a number of years. And he was one of the inspirations of why I wanted to be a writer. I had three: Ray Bradbury, Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond books, and W. Somerset Maugham, all for different reasons of the craft of writing. And when I finished this and I knew it was going to be published, I went to Ray. And I said, I'm finally getting published, Ray. I'm wondering if you would offer a blurb, which is, you know, standard practice in this business. And he said, well, Steve, as you know, I've had a couple strokes. I'm blind in one eye, and I don't see well in the other, and I'm having a very hard time even reading my own work. And, of course, at this point, I feel about 3 inches tall, and I'm just about ready to say, oh, well, Ray, then don't worry about it. Really, I don't want to impose. And then he says, but I'll be happy to. and that's Ray to a T. He's the most generous man you've ever met in your life, especially to other authors. But he's sincere, and he said, if I don't like it, I won't give you a blurb. And I said, Ray, I wouldn't ask under any other condition. But he did, indeed, and offered the blurb, and I've been thrilled ever since.
So in a nutshell, I mean, you described who the Fixer is and where he works. Can you tell us a little bit, without giving anything away, a little bit of the plot of Blood is Pretty?
Well, let's see. Basically, I need to quickly put on some glasses. In this film, this plot lays out two fixes that he does in Hollywood at this time. He comes to the rescue, first of all, to a woman he sees as the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. And he has seen a lot of beautiful women. And he has been hired by her to extricate herself from the grip of a soul-sucking sexual desires of a producer born in slime, of which many producers here are. And he also, at the same time, takes on the task for a film director of minuscule talent to buy off this film geek who's written a brilliant film treatment. And the director wants to buy off the geek and claim the treatment as his own and claim authorship for it. So Fixer's hired to do things like that. But what happens is one day the film geek is discovered dismembered and laid out all over his apartment. And when something like that happens, Fixer's kind of moral sense kicks in, his knight-errant-hood, if you will, and he decides, I'm going to find out why this film geek, this film nerd was killed, and in this horrendous manner. And in doing that, he winds up finding worlds of evil, both real and virtual, all concerning a computer program called Veritas. And whoever gets their hands on this computer program will wind up the richest person on the face of the planet.
Wow. Okay, so you wrote this book a few years ago. When did it come out?
It came out in 2003 in print. And now, of course, what we're talking about is Crossroad Press is putting it out as an ebook.
So how does one get their hands on the ebook from Crossroad Press? And it's at a very economical price, I may add.
Indeed, $2.99 American. I don't know what that is Canadian these days.
$2.99.
We're pretty close. We always have been very close.
Yeah.
Cousins in the continent. There's three major places. You can go directly to Crossroad Press itself, which is www.crossroadpress.com. It's also available on Smashwords, which is a major portal for ebooks from independent publishers. And that would be www.smashwords.com. And in all of these, you just do a search for Blood is Pretty. And Smashwords right now is having a 50% discount offer until the end of July. And then, of course, if you have a Kindle, go to the Amazon Kindle store. And it can be downloaded wirelessly there.
Okay, so the two most important questions now that I have to ask. One is, because I read all the blurbs from various people, including myself, in the fact that this was your first novel. Now, I know there was a follow-up, which, if I'm not mistaken, was Hollywood is an All-Volunteer Army. Is that correct?
That's correct. It would be called Fixer, Hollywood is an All-Volunteer Army.
So will there be the opportunity, because as I said in my blurb, I want more Adventures of the Fixer. So will the second one be coming out?
I would hope so. My publisher there, a wonderful guy named David Neal Wilson, who that's our fourth member in the club, I think will be interested in doing that. What I want to do before we do that is do a final copy edit of the manuscript, the normal stuff an author likes to do. But it's ready to go. I want to see how this book does a little bit. And also, by the way, Crossroad Press is probably going to bring it out also as an audiobook. They're talking to a narrator actor now to do the book, and they also publish audiobooks.
Okay, so
soon you might be able to hear it.
So you know what my penultimate question was, which was the second most important question. Now, the important question, if Blood is Pretty is now out, and the next one, Hollywood is an All-Volunteer Army, is also coming out. Will this lead you to writing, because I know you haven't done any more, will this lead you to writing new Fixer stories?
I would love for it to. I think we have to wait and see how these do, and if they sort of tell me to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
By their success. One thing on the Amazon Kindle, Amazon's very interesting. The whole digital publishing revolution has really taken off since the Kindle. And in fact, it was reported today that Amazon has sold more digital books than hardcover books in the last year, which is a pretty amazing fact. But Amazon will, if a digital book really takes off, they have a program called Amazon Encore, where they will then bring it out in a new trade paperback version. So any of those things start to happen, and I would be compelled to write a third one. There's a bare-bones plot in my head, and it would be a great joy to sit down. I love spending time with this character. I think the readers are going to love spending time with the Fixer. He's my ideal.
Well, we look forward to more Fixer stories. In the meantime, the first one, Blood is Pretty, is now available on Crossroad Press, Smashwords, and also you can get it for the Amazon Kindle. I thank you very, very much, Steve, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter Anthony Holder, your vice president of the club.
That's Stephen Paul Leyva. Let's get all three names out there since we are now in a club. He's the author of Blood is Pretty, and you can find the book at Crossroads Press, at Smashwords, and also at Amazon Digital for the Kindle. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0049, and you'll find links to Steve's sites, plus all the other sites I've just mentioned in connection with the book.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
Guest, Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, Geraint Wyn-Davies, actor who is in a one-man show called Do Not Go Gentle, and we have an Idiot of the Day coming up as well. But first, one more item I want to get to on The Stuff File, in The Stuff File news. And under the headline of, Seriously, Mom and Dad, what are you thinking? You don't meet too many folks named Adolf anymore. And seriously, what parent in their right mind would do that to a child? In Britain, apparently there are some. An updated database has revealed about 20 babies born in Britain since World War II have indeed been named Adolf. The last little Adolf was registered in 2005. The database records go back to 1837 and reveal that before the war, there were 320 Adolfs registered in England and Wales. Research also uncovered some other unusual naming trends, with 10 Lancaster babies in the late 19th century named Fish Fish, and one registered with the full name Fish Fish Fish. Okay, let's just get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Actor Geraint Wyn-Davies is currently performing in a one-man show at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival called Do Not Go Gentle, which is based on the life and work of Dylan Thomas. Now, for those who can't get to Stratford, there is also a recorded album available called In My Craft of Sullen Art, Selected Stories and Poems by Dylan Thomas. Here's a little clip of that now.
Charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write on these spindrift pages, nor for the towering dead with their nightingales and psalms, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art.
And joining us on the program is the man who plays Dylan Thomas himself. That would be Garrett Wynn Davies. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks for being
on. How are you? I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You do this one-man show of Dylan Thomas, and for a lot of people who do one-man shows, it's a very personal journey. What is it for you to play Dylan Thomas?
Well, it's actually become more fascinating with each performance of the show, which I've done a number of times. It was written by a great friend of mine, Leon Pownall, and both of us were Welsh men who came to Canada. And, of course, Dylan Thomas was born in Swansea, and I was born about 2 miles away from where he was born. And I've always been fascinated with words, and, of course, other than Shakespeare, one of the great wordsmiths of history was Dylan Thomas. And so I don't know, I've found that Leon's take on Thomas's life and his works just strikes a chord in me that I think with each passing year and ages just resonates more.
Since you grew up in an area close to where Dylan Thomas is from, you're probably more familiar with Dylan Thomas than maybe the general population. Having said that, mm-hmm. in doing this, what did you learn about Dylan Thomas?
Oh, well, the fact that words... He was a man who wrote, when he first wrote, it wasn't so much the meaning of the word, it was the sound of the word, and it was the sound of one word next to another. So it's about the poetry of the sound of language. So I've become really fascinated with the sound of language, with how certain words juxtaposed next to other words become a symphony unto themselves. It's really quite the most musical thing I've learned. So about Thomas himself, it's that he was a composer as much as a poet, I think.
And again, going back to what I asked about knowing Dylan Thomas probably better than the general population, do you find that you're getting Dylan Thomas fans who are coming to the show, fans of theater in general, or do you have to kind of teach them about Dylan Thomas?
Well, it's actually been a real treat to find out how many people are affected by Dylan Thomas's work. I had no idea. And particularly on a platform like Stratford here, it's people who are already sort of won over by the works of Shakespeare. We sold out even before we started. So I think there are like 20 seats left or something. So I think they might even consider sort of adding stuff or we'll do benefits or something to try to get seats available. But yes, there are many, many people who are devotees of Dylan Thomas. And so it's great to be the guy who's the messenger to bring him to the folks.
The popularity is impressive, as you just mentioned. I mentioned the dates of the run. The run goes started July 2nd and goes through to the 11th of September. But in that run, 5 performances were added. So there's even the possibility of adding yet more?
Well, there has been some discussion. I'm not sure. No one's asked me yet. But there are some open dates. We'll see about that as the summer goes on. But you mentioned the CD earlier that we recorded in New York in the spring. It's also selling really well. So obviously people not only want to see the play, which is great, but they want to hear Thomas after they've seen the play. So if the play is doing its job in terms of keeping people interested in Dylan Thomas. I mean, the guy was a rock star back when he toured the U.S. in the early 50s. He was it. He was the Rolling Stones of his time.
And that's one thing. You mentioned the CD. Glenn Rovin from GPR Records, I saw him, his little blurb on Facebook just the other day talking about how well the album is doing. He seems to be very happy.
Yes, no, it's great, and there was a beautiful recording that Glenn and the gang did called the 100. It had 100 actors doing 100 poems, and it's selling really, really well. So poetry obviously isn't dead yet, which is terrific for us guys who like it.
It's amazing because you say poetry isn't dead yet, and I think as long as there's been poetry, there have been people talking about killing it off.
Exactly. And mind you, I suppose the modern, the modern version of poets are the rap, the fellows who do rap. It's our modern poetry, I suppose.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your acting career besides doing stage, because you've done it all, films, television, and stage. And we last spoke almost 20 years ago. You came to Canada. You also went to the United States. And how have you found the acting experience as a journeyman actor?
It constantly grows and constantly surprises. And it's wonderful to actually have had, and hopefully will have, continue to have, the variety. When we first spoke, it was about a vampire show that we were doing in the early 90s. And now the crazy wave of vampirism, in the last 4 years or whatever, continues. And it was really fun to do one of the quirky first ones back in the day, as it were. And then, I guess I've done a dozen television series as a leading actor or continuing character anyway. So that was interesting, but I've played in the classics in the theater always since 1975. So I don't know. You end up doing film in Germany or Spain, and then you end up on a theater in England or in America. You get to meet some wonderful practitioners of their craft in each country, and where you get to take it with you wherever you go next. I guess the idea of staying put too long anywhere goes against the itinerant journeyman player. So I guess that's why I've always sort of moved on and tried to experience as many different things as I could.
That show you referred to, by the way, the one you did as a vampire, Forever Night, was that program that you did back in the day. Now, I understand you first got the acting... Yeah, back in the day. I understand you got the acting bug when you were about 12.
Well, actually, it was even earlier. It was seven, because my dad's a preacher, and it was back in Wales. And I used to sit on the organist's bench with the organist and look over at the chapel, looking at the congregation. And Dad's doing his thing, and he was wonderful. He's a captivating preacher. He's actually one of the greatest, I think. And I'd listen to the music and the people being sort of enwrapped in what Dad was saying, and I really liked that part, I suppose. It's just, I don't think the color would have fit very well on me, so I tried to the alternative, which I suppose was just being a thespian. And then when I was about 12, I did my first play in a professional theater, in Toronto, and that was it. That was it for me. I was toast then. There was no turning back.
And I understand you actually made your professional stage debut right here in this province, in Quebec City, in the Fantastics.
Oh, it was great. Absolutely. It was an English-speaking theater in Quebec City, and it was one of the most idyllic summers I've ever spent. It was doing Midsummer Night's Dream and The Fantastics, and a Canadian play called Red Emma. And it was one of those great things, a group of young actors doing summer stock theater in a wonderful place. We're right beneath Chateau Frontenac. And it was idyllic. And then not too long after, I was in Montreal doing stuff at the Centaur. And just, well, I would have moved there, but I guess careers take you where they take you. But yeah, mm. it was wonderful to be part of the Quebec experience, particularly in the mid-70s.
Okay, so you talk about the camaraderie and being at that young age and working in a stage play and the camaraderie of all the actors and doing those performances together. Flash forward to what you're doing now, Dylan Thomas. It's a one-man show. What's the difference for you as an actor in doing a one-man show than doing a piece with several performers?
Well, I'll tell you, it's different doing it here at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival because you're part of a company, and I'm also in The Tempest with Christopher Plummer, which is great. So there is the energy of a lot of people around, and the hallways are filled with other actors. So even when you go into your little dressing room and have to go onto the stage on your own, which is a daunting experience, once the show starts, it's fantastic. It's just an experience. But the going in and leaving the theater sometimes is... isolated, lonely, no man is an island, well, you feel like one kind of experience. This winter, however, in New York, doing the play off-Broadway, it was desolate because there was nobody to play with. And that's the one thing that, as an actor, you really do look for other people to sort of bounce off. So in a one-man show, the audience becomes the other character. So you really, really depend and enjoy and cajole, and the show shifts and changes quite a bit. As the relationship with the audience shifts as well. So I find that interesting. So you get to understand audiences a bit. It doesn't always work. And there's the collective consciousness that um, says, we like you today, or not so much. So you really get to feel that early on and have to adjust accordingly. So that's actually quite a fascinating experience. And you don't get to do that as much when you're working in an ensemble, because you're playing with each other, which is the true delight, I think, of acting.
Once you finish your run at Stratford, will you perhaps take the show back to New York or other places on the road?
Well, there's chats of doing it in Chautauqua, which is upstate New York, and Detroit. So I'll see about that. I'll make that decision in the next little while. But I think I'll do that. They're short runs. They're in festival kind of situations. And so I would do that. But then, yeah, I think the one-man show is so fabulous, but it's very difficult to do. And this is, I don't know how many others I would be seeking to do in my career. I think Dylan Thomas was close to my heart, and I think I would do it as benefits and things like that in the future, but I'm not sure. I think I've had a really, really good go at it. I will have had one this summer, and particularly also this past winter in New York.
Well, I know you're very, very busy with the show, and again, it's playing at the Stratford, and people can check, as the saying goes, the website and their local listings. I thank you very, very much, Garrett, for being on the program with us.
Oh, Peter, thanks a lot. It was fun to talk to you, and we'll have to do it every 20 years.
Will do. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye, Peter.
Actor Geraint Wyn-Davies, star of the one-man show at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival called Do Not Go Gentle. The album is also available. It's called In My Craft of Sullen Art, selected stories and poems by Dylan Thomas. You can find links to the Stratford Festival and also links to Amazon.com, where you can order the album by going to my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0049, and you will find all the links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
This is The Stuff File.
And before we wrap things up, we have time for just one more item, and of course you know what that is, don't you? Yes, of course, it's the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
A clerk at a convenience store in Austin, Texas, told police that a man tried to rob him with the aid of an unusual weapon, a caulking gun. Clerk Johnny Lemuel, age 68, who knew he was not in danger from the tool, refused to open his cash drawer. The robber, knowing he had nothing to shoot with, hit Lemuel with the tool. The clerk fought back, hitting the robber with a trash can. The robber fled with a man police know as a prostitute who dresses as a woman. Police identified the robbery suspect as Jose Alejandro Romero, age 17. Romero fled without getting any money, and an arrest warrant has been issued. That's one confused kid, and it doesn't sound like that confusion will be cleared up anytime soon. Why would someone try to rob a store with a caulking gun? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of The Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0049. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the website, you'll find all the information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that number is 0049. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can find me at Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and on Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, streaming on pcjmedia.com, and over the air on World FM 88.2 in New Zealand, and also Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up!